wheels of a grain cart, and he died from his injuries. They buried him there. It's a nice headstone with Robert Clay Allison, 1840 to 1887, on it. I've seen it. And an inscription. The inscription says, "He never killed a man that did not need killing." What do you think of that?
I think it's a fine inscription, Reacher said.
There's an old newspaper, too, she said, in a glass case from Kansas City, I think, with his obituary in it. It says, "Certain it is that many of his stern deeds were for the right, as he understood that right to be." The Cadillac sped on south.
"A fine obituary," Reacher said.
"You think so?"
He nodded. "As good as you can get, probably."
"Would you like an obituary like that?"
"Well, not just yet," Reacher said. She smiled again, apologetically.
"No," she said, "I guess not. But do you think you would like to qualify for an obituary like that? I mean, eventually."
"I can think of worse things," he said.
She said nothing.
"You want to tell me where this is heading?" he asked.
"This road?"
she said nervously.
"No, this conversation."
She drove on for a spell, and then she lifted her foot off the gas pedal and coasted. The car slowed, and she pulled off onto the dusty shoulder. The shoulder fell away into a dry irrigation ditch, and it put the car at a crazy angle, tilted way down on his side. She put the transmission in park with a small, delicate motion of her wrist, and she left the engine idling and the air roaring.
"My name is Carmen Greer," she said, "and I need your help."
2.
"It wasn't an accident. I picked you up, you know," Carmen Greer said.
Reacher's back was pressed against his door. The Cadillac was listing like a sinking ship, canted hard over on the shoulder. The slippery leather seat gave him no leverage to struggle upright. The woman had one hand on the wheel and the other on his seat back, propping herself above him. Her face was a foot away. It was unreadable. She was looking past him, out at the dust of the ditch.
"You're going to be able to drive off this slope?" he asked.
She glanced back and up at the blacktop. Its rough surface was shimmering with heat, about level with the base of her window.
"I think so," she said.
"I hope so."
"I hope so, too," he said.
She just stared at him. "So, why did you pick me up?" he asked.
"Why do you think?"
"I don't know," he said. "I thought I just got lucky. I guess I thought you were a kind person doing a stranger a favor."
She shook her head.
"No. I was looking for a guy like you," she said.
"Why?"
"I must have picked up a dozen guys," she said, "and I've seen hundreds. That's about all I've been doing all month long, cruising around West Texas, looking at who needs a ride."
"Why?"
She shrugged the question away, a dismissive little gesture.
"The miles I've put on this car," she said, "it's unbelievable. And the money I've spent on gas."
"Why?" he asked again.
She went quiet, wouldn't answer, just went into a long silence. The armrest on the door was digging into his kidney. He arched his back and pressed with his shoulders and adjusted his position. Found himself wishing somebody else had picked him up, somebody content just to motor from A to B. He looked up at her.
Can I call you Carmen? He asked.
She nodded.
Sure. Please. Okay, Carmen, he said. Tell me what's going on here, will you?
Her mouth opened, and then it closed again. Opened and closed. I don't know how to start, she said. Now that it's come to it.
Come to what?
She wouldn't answer.
You better tell me exactly what you want, he said, or I'm getting out of the car right here, right now.
It's 110 degrees out there.
I know it is.
A person could die in this heat.
I'll take my chances.
You can't get your door open, she said. The car is tilted too much.
Then I'll punch out the windshield.
She paused a beat. I need your help, she said again.
You never saw me before.
Not personally, she said. But you fit the bill.
What bill?
She went quiet again, came up with a brief, ironic smile.
It's so difficult, she said.
I've rehearsed this speech a million times, but now I don't know if it's going to come out right.
Reacher said nothing, just waited.
You ever had anything to do with lawyers?
She asked.
They don't do anything for you. They just want a lot of money and a lot of time, and then they tell you there's nothing much to be done.
So get a new lawyer, he said.
I've had 4, she said. 4 in a month. They're all the same, and they're all too expensive. I don't have enough money.
You're driving a Cadillac.
It's my mother-in-law's. I'm only borrowing it.
You're wearing a big diamond ring.
She went quiet again, her eyes clouded. My husband gave it to me, she said. He looked at her.
So can't he help you?
No, he can't help me, she said. Have you ever gone looking for a private detective?
Never needed one. I was a detective.
They don't really exist, she said. Not like you see in the movies. They just want to sit in their offices and work with the phone, or on their computers with their databases. They won't come out and actually do anything for you. I went all the way to Austin. A guy there said he could help, but he wanted to use 6 men and charge me nearly $10,000 a week.
For what?
So I got desperate. I was really panicking. Then I got this idea. I figured if I looked at people hitching rides, I might find somebody. One of them might turn out to be the right type of person and willing to help me. I tried to choose pretty carefully. I only stopped for rough-looking men.
Thanks, Carmen, Reacher said.
I don't mean it badly, she said. It's not uncomplimentary.
But it could have been dangerous.
She nodded.
It nearly was, a couple of times. But I had to take the risk. I had to find somebody. I figured I might get rodeo guys or men from the oil fields. You know, tough guys, roughnecks, maybe out of work with a little time on their hands, maybe a little anxious to earn some money, but I can't pay much. Is that going to be a problem?
So far, Carmen, everything is going to be a problem.
She went quiet again. I talked to them all, she said. You know, chatted with them a little, discussed things like we did. I was trying to make some kind of judgment about what they were like inside in terms of their characters. I was trying to assess their qualities, maybe 12 of them. And none of them were really any good. But I think you are.
You think I'm what?
I think you're my best chance so far, she said. Really, I do. A former cop, been in the army, no ties anywhere, you couldn't be better.
I'm not looking for a job, Carmen. She nodded happily.
I know, I figured that out already. But that's better still, I think. It keeps it pure. Don't you see that? Help for help's sake. No mercenary aspect to it. And your background is perfect. It obligates you.
He stared at her. No, it doesn't.
You were a soldier, she said, and a policeman. It's perfect. You're supposed to help people. That's what cops do.
We spent most of our time busting heads. Not a whole lot of helping went on.
But it must have. That's what cops are for. It's like their fundamental duty. And an army cop is even better. You said it yourself. You do what's necessary.
If you need a cop, go to the county sheriff, Pecos, or wherever it is.
Echo, she said. I live in Echo, south of Pecos.
Wherever, he said. Go to the sheriff. She was shaking her head.
No, I can't do that.
Reacher said nothing more, just lay half on his back, pressed up against the door by the car's steep angle. The engine was idling patiently, and the air was still roaring. The woman was still braced above him. She had gone silent. She was staring out past him and blinking, like she was about to cry, like she was ready for a big flood of tears, like she was tragically disappointed. Maybe with him, maybe with herself.
You must think I'm crazy, she said.
He turned his head and looked hard at her, top to toe. Strong, slim legs, strong, slim arms, the expensive dress. It was riding up on her thighs, and he could see her bra strap at her shoulder. It was snow white against the color of her skin. She had clean, combed hair and trimmed, painted nails. An elegant, intelligent face. Tired eyes.
I'm not crazy, she said.
Then she looked straight at him. Something in her face. Maybe an appeal. Or maybe hopelessness. Or desperation.
It's just that I've dreamed about this for a month, she said. My last hope. It was a ridiculous plan, I guess, but it's all I had. And there was always the chance it would work. And with you, I think maybe it could. And now I'm screwing it up by coming across like a crazy woman.
He paused a long time. Minutes. He thought back to a pancake house he'd seen in Lubbock, right across the strip from his motel. It had looked pretty good. He could have crossed the street, gone in there, had a big stack with bacon on the side, lots of syrup, maybe an egg. He would have come out a half hour after she blew town. He could be sitting next to some cheerful trucker now, listening to rock and roll on the radio. On the other hand, he could be bruised and bleeding in a police cell with an arraignment date coming up.
So start over, he said. Just say what you've got to say. But first, drive us out of this damn ditch. I'm very uncomfortable, and I could use a cup of coffee. Is there any place up ahead where we could get coffee?
I think so, she said. Yes, there is, about an hour, I think.
So let's go there. Let's get a cup of coffee.
You're going to dump me and run, she said.
It was an attractive possibility. She stared at him, maybe 5 long seconds, and then she nodded like a decision was made. She put the transmission in D and hit the gas. The car had front-wheel drive, and all the weight was on the back, so the tires just clawed at nothing and spun. Gravel rattled against the underbody, and a cloud of hot, khaki dust rose up all around them. Then the tires caught, and the car heaved itself out of the ditch and bounced up over the edge of the blacktop. She got it straight in the lane, and then she floored it and took off south.
I don't know where to begin, she said.
At the beginning, he said. Always works best that way. Think about it. Tell me over coffee. We've got the time.
She shook her head, stared forward through the windshield, eyes locked on the empty shimmering road ahead. She was quiet for a mile, already doing 70.
No, we don't, she said. It's real urgent.
50 miles southwest of Abilene, on a silent county road 10 miles north of the main east-west highway, the Crown Victoria waited quietly on the shoulder, its engine idling, its hood unlatched and standing an inch open for better cooling. All around it was flatness so extreme the curvature of the earth was revealed. The dusty, parched brush falling slowly away to the horizon in every direction. There was no traffic, and therefore no noise beyond the tick and whisper of the idling engine and the heavy buzz of the earth baking and cracking under the unbearable heat of the sun. The driver had the electric door mirror racked all the way outward, so he could see the whole of the road behind him. The Crown Vic's own dust had settled, and the view was clear for about a mile, right back to the point where the blacktop and the sky mixed together and broke and boiled into a silvery, shimmering mirage. The driver had his eyes focused on that distant glare, waiting for it to be pierced by the indistinct shape of a car. He knew what car it would be. The team was well briefed. It would be a white Mercedes-Benz, driven by a man on his own toward an appointment he couldn't miss. The man would be driving fast, because he would be running late, because he was habitually late for everything. They knew the time of his appointment, and they knew his destination was 30 miles farther on up the road. So simple arithmetic gave them a target time they could set their watches by, a target time that was fast approaching.
So, let's do it, the driver said.
He stepped out of the car into the heat and clicked the hood down into place, slid back into the seat, and took a ball cap from the woman. It was one of 3 bought from a souvenir vendor on Hollywood Boulevard, $13.95 each. It was dark blue, with FBI machine embroidered in white cotton thread across the front. The driver squared it on his head and pulled the peak low over his eyes, moved the transmission lever into drive, and kept his foot hard on the brake, leaned forward a fraction, and kept his eyes on the mirror.
Right on time, he said.
The silver mirage was boiling and wobbling, and a white shape pulled free of it and speared out toward them like a fish leaping out of water. The shape settled and steadied on the road, moving fast, crouching low. A white Mercedes sedan, wide tires, dark windows. The driver eased his foot off the brake, and the Crown Vic crawled forward through the dust. He touched the gas when the Mercedes was still 100 yards behind him. The Mercedes roared past and the Crown Vic pulled out into the hot blast of its slipstream. The driver straightened the wheel and accelerated, smiled with his lips hard together. The killing crew was going to work again. The Mercedes driver saw headlights flashing in his mirror and looked again and saw the sedan behind him, two peaked caps silhouetted in the front seat. He dropped his eyes automatically to his speedometer, which was showing more than 90, felt the cold, oh shit, stab in his chest, eased off the gas while he calculated how late he was already and how far he still had to go and what his best approach to these guys should be. Humility? Or maybe, I'm too important to be hassled? Or what about a sort of, come on, guys, I'm working too, camaraderie? The sedan pulled alongside as he slowed, and he saw three people, one of them a woman. Radio antennas all over the car. No lights, no siren. Not regular cops. The driver was waving him to the shoulder. The woman was pressing an ID wallet against her window. It had FBI in 2-inch-high letters. Their caps said FBI. Serious-looking people in some kind of duty fatigues. Serious-looking squad car. He relaxed a little. The FBI didn't stop you for speeding. Must be something else. Maybe some kind of security check, which made sense, considering what lay 30 miles up the road. He nodded to the woman and braked and eased right onto the shoulder. He feathered the pedal and coasted to a stop in a big cloud of dust. The bureau car eased up and stopped behind him, the brightness of its headlight beams dimmed by the cloud. The way to do it is to keep them quiet and alive as long as possible. Postpone any kind of struggle. Struggling leads to evidence, blood and fibers and body fluids spraying and leaking all over the place. So they all three got out of the car at a medium speed, like they were harassed professionals dealing with something important, but not something right up there at the top of their agenda.
"Mr. Eugene," the woman called. "Al Eugene, right?"
The Mercedes driver opened his door and slid out of his seat and stood up in the heat and the glare. He was around 30, not tall, dark and sallow, soft and rounded. He faced the woman, and she saw some kind of innate southern courtesy toward women place him at an immediate disadvantage.
"What can I do for you, ma'am?" he asked.
"Your cellular phone not working, sir?"
the woman asked. Eugene patted at the pocket of his suit coat.
"Should be," he said.
"May I see it, sir?"
Eugene took it out of his pocket and handed it over. The woman dialed the number and looked surprised.
"Seems okay," she said. "Sir, can you spare us 5 minutes?"
"Maybe," Eugene said, "if you tell me what for."
"We have an FBI assistant director a mile up the road. Needs to speak with you. Something urgent, I guess, or we wouldn't be here. And something pretty important, or we'd have been told what it's all about."
Eugene pulled back his cuff and looked at his watch.
"I have an appointment," he said.
The woman was nodding.
"We know about that, sir. We took the liberty of calling ahead and rescheduling for you. 5 minutes is all we need."
Eugene shrugged.
"Can I see some ID?" he asked.
The woman handed over her wallet. It was made of worn black leather and had a milky plastic window on the outside. There was an FBI photo ID behind it, laminated and embossed and printed with the kind of slightly old-fashioned typeface the federal government might use. Like most people in the United States, Eugene had never seen an FBI ID. He assumed he was looking at his first.
throw to peace, he said.
Okay, I'll follow you, I guess.
We'll drive you,
the woman said. There's a checkpoint in place, and civilian cars make them real nervous. We'll bring you right back. 5 minutes is all.
Eugene shrugged again.
Okay, he said.
They all walked as a group back toward the Crown Vic. The driver held the front passenger door for Eugene.
You ride up here, sir, he said. They're listing you as a Class A individual, and if we put a Class A individual in the back seat, then we'll get our asses kicked, but good. That's for damn sure.
They saw Eugene swell up a little from his assigned status. He nodded and ducked down and slid into the front seat. Either he hadn't noticed they still had his phone, or he didn't care. The driver closed the door on him and ducked around the hood to his own. The tall, fair man and the woman climbed into the rear. The Crown Vic eased around the parked bends and pulled left onto the blacktop, accelerated up to about 55.
Ahead,
the woman said. The driver nodded.
I see it, he said. We'll make it.
There was a plume of dust on the road, 3 or 4 miles into the distance. It was rising up and dragging left in the faint breeze. The driver slowed, hunting the turn he had scouted 30 minutes before. He spotted it and pulled left and crossed the opposite shoulder and bumped down through a depression where the road was built up like a causeway. Then he slewed to the right, tight in behind a stand of brush tall enough to hide the car. The man and the woman in the rear seat came out with handguns and leaned forward and jammed them into Eugene's neck, right behind the ears, where the structure of the human skull provides 2 nice, muzzle-shaped sockets.
Sit real still, the woman said.
Eugene sat real still. 2 minutes later, a big, dark vehicle blasted by above them. A truck, or a bus. Dust clouded the sky, and the brush rustled in the moving air. The driver got out and approached Eugene's door with a gun in his hand. He opened the door and leaned in and jammed the muzzle into Eugene's throat, where the ends of the collarbones make another convenient socket.
Get out, he said, real careful.
What?
Was all Eugene could say.
We'll tell you what, the woman said. Now get out.
Eugene got out, with 3 guns at his head.
Step away from the car, the woman said. Walk away from the road.
This was the tricky time. Eugene was glancing around as far and as fast as he dared move his head. His eyes were jumping. His body was twitching. He stepped away from the car. 1 pace, 2, 3. Eyes everywhere. The woman nodded.
Al?
She called loudly. Her 2 partners jumped away, long sideways strides. Eugene's head snapped around to face the woman who had called his name. She shot him through the right eye. The sound of the gun clapped and rolled across the hot landscape like thunder. The back of Eugene's head came off in a messy cloud, and he went straight down and sprawled in a loose tangle of arms and legs. The woman stepped around him and crouched down and took a closer look. Then she stepped away and stood up straight with her legs and arms spread like she was ready to be searched at the airport.
Chet,
she said. The 2 men stepped close and examined every inch of her skin and clothing. They checked her hair and her hands. Clear, the small dark man said.
Clear,
the tall, fair man said. She nodded, a faint smile. No residue, no evidence, no blood or bone or brains anywhere on her person.
Okay,
she said. The two men stepped back to Eugene and took an arm and a leg each, and dragged his body 10 feet into the brush. They had found a narrow limestone cleft there, a crack in the rock maybe 8 feet deep and a foot and a half across, wide enough to take a man's corpse sideways, too narrow to admit the 6-foot wingspan of a vulture or a buzzard. They maneuvered the body until the trailing hand and the trailing foot fell into the hole. Then they lowered away carefully until they were sure the torso would fit. This guy was fatter than some, but he slid in without snagging on the rock. As soon as they were sure, they dropped him the rest of the way. He wedged tight, about 7 feet down. The bloodstains were already drying and blackening. They kicked desert dust over them and swept the area with a mesquite branch to confuse the mass of footprints. Then they walked over and climbed into the Crown Vic, and the driver backed up and swung through the brush, bounced through the dip and up the slope to the roadway. The big car nosed back the way it had come and accelerated gently to 55 miles an hour. Moments later, it passed by Eugene's white Mercedes, parked right where he had left it, on the other side of the road. It already looked abandoned and filmed with dust.
"I have a daughter," Carmen Greer said. "I told you that, right?"
"You told me you were a mother," Reacher said. She nodded at the wheel.
"Of a daughter. She's 6 and a half years old."
Then she went quiet for a minute.
"They called her Mary Ellen," she said.
"They?"
"My husband's family."
"They named your kid?"
"It just happened, I guess. I wasn't in a good position to stop it."
Reacher was quiet for a beat.
"What would you have called her?" he asked.
She shrugged.
"Gloria, maybe? I thought she was glorious."
She went quiet again.
"But she's Mary Ellen," he said.
She nodded.
"They call her Ellie, for short. Miss Ellie, sometimes."
"And she's 6 and a half?
"But we've been married less than 7 years. I told you that, too, right? So you can do the math. Is that a problem?"
"Doing the math?"
"Thinking about the implication?"
He shook his head at the windshield.
"Not a problem to me. Why would it be?"
"Not a problem to me either," she said. "But it explains why I wasn't in a good position."
He made no reply.
"We got off to all kinds of a bad start," she said, "me and his family."
She said it with a dying fall in her voice, the way a person might refer back to a tragedy in the past, a car wreck, a plane crash, a fatal diagnosis, the way a person might refer back to the day her life changed forever. She gripped the wheel and the car drove itself on, a cocoon of cold and quiet in the blazing landscape.
"Who are they?" he asked.
"The Greers," she said. "An old Echo County family. Been there since Texas was first stolen. Maybe they were there to steal some of it themselves."
"What are they like?"
"They're what you might expect," she said. "Old white Texans. Big money from way back. A lot of it gone now, but a lot of it still left. Some history with oil and cattle ranching. River-baptized Protestants. Not that they ever go to church or think about what the Lord might be saying to them. They hunt animals for pleasure. The father died some time ago. The mother is still alive. There are 2 sons and there are cousins all over the county. My husband is the elder boy, Sloop Greer."
"Sloop?" Reacher said.
She smiled for the first time since driving out of the ditch.
Sloop,
she said again.
What kind of a name is that?
An old family name, she said. Some ancestor, I guess. Probably he was at the Alamo, fighting against mine.
Sounds like a boat. What's the other boy called? Yacht? Tug? Ocean liner? Oil tanker?
Robert,
she said.
People call him Bobby.
Sloop, Reacher said again. That's a new one to me.
New to me, too, she said. The whole thing was new to me. But I used to like his name. It marked him out, somehow.
I guess it would.
I met him in California, Carmen said. We were in school together, UCLA.
Off of his home turf, Reacher said.
She stopped smiling.
Correct. Only way it could have happened, looking back. If I'd have met him out here, you know, with the whole package out in plain view, it would never have happened. No way. I can promise you that. Always assuming I'd even come out here in the first place, which I hope I wouldn't have.
She stopped talking and squinted ahead into the glare of the sun. There was a ribbon of black road and a bright shape up ahead on the left, shiny aluminum broken into moving fragments by the haze boiling up off the blacktop.
There's a diner, she said. They'll have coffee, I'm sure.
Strange kind of a diner if it didn't, he said.
There are lots of strange things here, she said.
The diner sat alone on the side of the road, set on a slight rise in the center of an acre of beaten dirt, serving as its parking lot. There was a sign on a tall pole, and no shade anywhere. There were two pickup trucks, carelessly parked, far from each other.
Okay,
she said, hesitant, starting to slow the car.
Now you're going to run. You figure one of those guys with the pickups will give you a ride.
He said nothing.
If you are, do it later, okay? She said. Please? I don't want to be left alone in a place like this.
She slowed some more and bounced off the road onto the dirt, parked right next to the sign pole, as if it was a shade tree offering protection from the sun. Its slender shadow fell across the hood like a bar. She pushed the lever into park and switched off the engine. The air conditioner's compressor hissed and gurgled in the sudden silence. Reacher opened his door. The heat hit him like a steel-yard furnace. It was so intense he could barely catch his breath. He stood dumb for a second and waited for her, and then they walked together across the hot dirt. It was baked dry and hard, like concrete. Beyond it was a tangle of mesquite brush and a blinding, white-hot sky as far as the eye could see. He let her walk half a pace ahead of him so he could watch her. She had her eyes half-closed and her head bowed like she didn't want to see or be seen. The hem on her dress had fallen to a decorous knee length. She moved very gracefully, like a dancer, her upper body erect and perfectly still, and her bare legs scissoring elegantly below it. The diner had a tiny foyer with a cigarette machine and a rack full of flyers about real estate and oil changes and small-town rodeos and gun shows. Inside the second door, it was cold again. They stood together in the delicious chill for a moment. There was a register next to the door, and a tired waitress sitting sideways on a counter stool. A cook visible in the kitchen, two men in separate booths, eating. All four people looked up and paused, like there were things they could say, but wouldn't. Reacher looked at each of them for a second, and then turned away and led Carmen to a booth at the far end of the room. He slid across sticky vinyl and tilted his head back into a jet of cold air coming down from a vent in the ceiling. Carmen sat opposite and raised her head, and he looked at her face on for the first time.
"My daughter looks nothing at all like me," she said. "Sometimes I think that's the cruelest irony in this whole situation. Those big old Greer jeans just about steamrollered mine, that's for sure."
She had spectacular dark eyes with long lashes and a slight tilt to them, and a straight nose that made an open Y shape against her brows, high cheekbones framed by thick black hair that shone navy in the light, a rosebud of a mouth with a subtle trace of red lipstick. Her skin was smooth and clear, the color of weak tea or dark honey, and it had a translucent glow behind it. It was actually a whole lot lighter in color than Reach's own sunburned forearms, and he was white, and she wasn't.
"So who does Ellie look like?" he asked.
"Them," she said.
The waitress brought ice water and a pad and a pencil and an upturned chin and no conversation. Carmen ordered iced coffee, and Reacher ordered his hot and black.
"She doesn't look like she's mine at all," Carmen said. "Pink skin, yellow hair, a little chubby, but she's got my eyes."
"Lucky Ellie," Reacher said.
She smiled briefly.
"Thank you. Plan is she should stay lucky."
She held the water glass flat against her face. Then she used a napkin to wipe the dew away. The waitress brought their drinks. The iced coffee was in a tall glass, and she spilled some of it as she put it down. Reacher's was in an insulated plastic carafe, and she shoved an empty china mug across the table next to it. She left the check face down halfway between the two drinks and walked away without saying anything at all.
"You need to understand, I loved soup once," Carmen said.
Reacher made no reply, and she looked straight at him.
"Does it bother you to hear this kind of stuff?" she asked.
He shook his head, although the truth was it did bother him a little. Loners aren't necessarily too comfortable with a stranger's intimacies.
"You told me to start at the beginning," she said.
"Yes," he said, "I did."
"So I will," she said. "I loved him once. You need to understand that. And you need to understand that wasn't hard to do. He was big, and he was handsome, and he smiled a lot, and he was casual, and he was relaxed. And we were in school, and we were young. And L.A. is a very special place, where anything seems possible, and nothing seems to matter very much."
She took a drinking straw from the canister on the table and unwrapped it.
"And you need to know where I was coming from," she said. "Truth is, I had it all completely backward. I wasn't some Mexican worrying about whether the white family would accept me. I was worrying about my family accepting this gringo boy. That's how it seemed to me. I come from 1,000 acres in Napa. We've been there forever. We were always the richest people I knew, and the most cultured. We had the art and the history and the music. We gave to museums. We employed white people. So I spent my time worrying about what my folks would say about me marrying out."
He sipped his coffee. It was stewed and old, but it would do.
"And what did they say?" he asked.
"They went insane. I thought they were being foolish. Now I understand they weren't."
"So what happened?"
She sipped her drink through the straw, took a napkin from a canister, and dabbed her lips. It came away marked with her lipstick.
"Well, I was pregnant," she said. And that made everything a million times worse, of course. My parents are very devout, and they're very traditional. And basically they cut me off, I guess. They disowned me. It was like the whole Victorian thing, expelled from the snowy doorstep with a bundle of rags. Except it wasn't snowing, of course. And the bundle of rags was really a Louis Vuitton valise.
So what did you do?
We got married. Nobody came, just a few friends from school. We lived a few months in L.A. We graduated. We stayed there until the baby was a month away. It was fun, actually. We were young and in love. He poured himself a second cup of coffee.
But? He asked.
But Sloop couldn't find a job. I began to realize he wasn't trying very hard. Getting a job wasn't in his plan. College was 4 years of fun for him. Then it was back to the fold, go take over Daddy's business. His father was ready to retire by then. I didn't like that idea. I thought we were starting up fresh on our own. You know, a new generation on both sides. I felt I'd given stuff up. And I thought he should, too. So we argued a lot. I couldn't work because of being so pregnant, and I had no money of my own. So in the end, we couldn't make the rent. So in the end, he won the argument, and we trailed back here to Texas, and we moved into the big old house with his folks and his brother and his cousins all around. And I'm still there.
The dying fall was back in her voice, the day her life changed forever. And? He asked. She looked straight at him.
And it was like the ground opens up and you fall straight through to hell. It was such a shock. I couldn't even react at all. They treated me strange. And the second day, I suddenly realized what was going on. All my life, I'd been like a princess, you know? And then I was just a hip kid among 10,000 others in L.A. But now, I was suddenly just a piece of beaner trash. They never said it straight out, but it was so clear. They hated me, because I was the greaseball whore who had hooked their darling boy. They were painfully polite. Because I guess their strategy was to wait for Sloop to come to his senses and dump me. It happens, you know, in Texas. The good old boys, when they're young and foolish, they like a little dark meat. Sometimes it's like a rite of passage. Then they wise up and straighten out. I knew that's what they were thinking and hoping. And it was a shock, believe me. I had never thought of myself like that. Never. I'd never had to. Never had to confront it. The whole world was turned upside down in an instant. Like falling in freezing water. Couldn't breathe. Couldn't think. Couldn't even move.
But he didn't dump you, evidently.
She looked down at the table. No, she said. He didn't dump me. He started hitting me instead. First time, he punched me in the face. Then Ellie was born the next day.
The Crown Victoria turned back into a normal Hertz rental behind a stand of trees 8 miles off the highway, halfway between Abilene and Big Spring. The Virginia plates came off, and the Texas plates went back on. The plastic wheel covers were kicked back into place. The cellular antennas were peeled off the rear glass and laid back in the valise. The CB whips pulled clear of the sheet metal and joined them. The souvenir ball caps were nested together and packed away with the handguns. Eugene's mobile phone was smashed against a rock, and the pieces hurled deep into the thicket. A little grit from the shoulder of the road was sprinkled onto the front passenger seat so that the rental people would have to vacuum up any of Eugene's stray hairs and fibers along with it. Then the big sedan pulled back onto the blacktop and wound its way back to the highway. It cruised comfortably, heading west, a forgettable vehicle filled with three forgettable people. It made one more stop at a comfort area named for the Colorado River, where sodas were consumed and a call was made from an untraceable payphone. The call was to Las Vegas, from where it was rerouted to Dallas, from where it was rerouted to an office in a small town in the west of Texas. The call reported complete success so far, and it was gratefully received.
"He split my lip and loosened my teeth,"
Carmen Greer said. Reacher watched her face.
"That was the first time," she said. "He just lost it.
But straight away he was full of remorse. He drove me to the emergency room himself. It's a long, long drive from the house, hours and hours, and the whole way he was begging me to forgive him. Then he was begging me not to tell the truth about what had happened. He seemed really ashamed, so I agreed. But I never had to say anything anyway, because as soon as we arrived, I started into labor, and they took me straight upstairs to the delivery unit. Ellie was born the next day."
"And then what?"
"And then it was okay," she said. "For a week, at least. Then he started hitting me again. I was doing everything wrong. I was paying too much attention to the baby. I didn't want sex because I was hurting from the stitches. He said I had gotten fat and ugly from the pregnancy."
Reacher said nothing.
"He got me believing it," she said. "For a long, long time. That happens, you know. You've got to be very self-confident to resist it. And I wasn't in that situation. He took away all my self-esteem. 2 or 3 years, I thought it was my fault, and I tried to do better."
"What did the family do?"
She pushed her glass away, left the iced coffee half-finished.
"They didn't know about it," she said. "And then his father died, which made it worse. He was the only reasonable one. He was okay. But now it's just his mother and his brother. He's awful, and she's a witch. And they still don't know. It happens in secret. It's a big house. It's like a compound, really. We're not all on top of each other. And it's all very complicated. He's way too stubborn and proud to ever agree with them he's made a mistake. So the more they're down on me, the more he pretends he loves me. He misleads them. He buys me things. He bought me this ring." She held up her right hand, bent delicately at the wrist, showing off the platinum band with the big diamond. It looked like a hell of a thing. Reacher had never bought a diamond ring. He had no idea what they cost. A lot, he guessed. "He bought me horses," she said. "They knew I wanted horses, and he bought them for me so he could look good in front of them. But really, to explain away the bruises, it was his stroke of genius, a permanent excuse. He makes me say, 'I've fallen off.' They know I'm still just learning to ride, and that explains a lot in rodeo country, bruises and broken bones. They take it for granted."
"He's broken your bones?"
She nodded and started touching parts of her body, twisting and turning in the confines of the tight booth, silently recounting her injuries, hesitating slightly now and then like she couldn't recall them all.
"My ribs, first of all, I guess," she said. He kicks me when I'm on the floor. He does that a lot when he's mad. My left arm, by twisting it. My collarbone. My jaw. I've had 3 teeth reimplanted.
He stared at her. She shrugged.
The emergency room people think I'm the worst writer in the history of the West.
They believe it?
Maybe they just choose to.
And his mother and brother?
Likewise,
she said.
Obviously, I'm not going to get the benefit of the doubt.
Why the hell did you stick around? Why didn't you just get out the very first time?
She sighed, and she closed her eyes, and she turned her head away, spread her hands on the table, palms down, and then turned them over, palms up. I can't explain it, she whispered. Nobody can ever explain it. You have to know what it's like. I had no confidence in myself. I had a newborn baby and no money, not a dime. I had no friends. I was watched all the time. I couldn't even make a call in private.
He said nothing. She opened her eyes and looked straight at him.
And worst of all, I had nowhere to go, she said.
Home? He said. She shook her head.
I never even thought about it, she said. Taking the beatings was better than trying to crawl back to my family with a white blonde baby in my arms.
He said nothing.
And the first time you pass up the chance, you've had it, she said. That's how it is. It just gets worse. Whenever I thought about it, I still had no money. I still had a baby. Then she was a 1-year-old, then a 2-year-old, then a 3-year-old. The time is never right. If you stay that first time, you're trapped forever. And I stayed that first time. I wish I hadn't, but I did.
He said nothing. She looked at him, appealing for something.
You have to take it on faith, she said. You don't know how it is. You're a man. You're big and strong. Somebody hits you, you hit him back. You're on your own. You don't like someplace, you move on. It's different for me. Even if you can't understand it, you have to believe it.
He said nothing.
I could have gone if I had left Ellie, she said. Sloop told me if I left the baby with him, he'd pay my fare any place I wanted to go. First class. He said he'd call a limo all the way from Dallas right there and then to take me straight to the airport.
He said nothing.
But I wouldn't do that, she said quietly. I mean, how could I? So Sloop makes out this is my choice, like I'm agreeing to it, like I want it. So he keeps on hitting me, punching me, kicking me, slapping me, humiliating me sexually, every day, even if he isn't mad at me. And if he is mad at me, he just goes crazy.
There was silence, just the rush of air from the cooling vents and the diner's ceiling, vague noise from the kitchens, Carmen Greer's low breathing, the clink of fracturing ice in her abandoned glass. He looked across the table at her, tracing his gaze over her hands, her arms, her neck, her face. The neckline of her dress had shifted left, and he could see a thickened knot on her collarbone, a healed break, no doubt about it. But she was sitting absolutely straight, with her head up and her eyes defiant, and her posture was telling him something. "He hits you every day?" he asked. She closed her eyes.
"Well, almost every day. Not literally, I guess. But 3-4 times in a week, usually. Sometimes more. It feels like every day.
He was quiet for a long moment, looking straight at her. Then he shook his head.
"You're making it up," he said.